Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and this is First Coast Connect. Today, sexual harassment in schools. We talk to a student who's fighting to bring the issue to light and asking the school board to take action. Later in the program, we talk to doctors and a survivor about the signs of and strategies to prevent sudden cardiac arrest. But first, the problem of sexual harassment and discrimination in schools is epidemic, according to my guests, and happening as early as first grade. I'm joined now by Duval County High School junior Darshini Banshees-Warren. Good morning, Darshini.
Hi, it's really great to be here.
It's great to have you. And Julia Squiteri, founder and executive director of the Ruth Project. Welcome, Julia.
Hi, thank you for having us.
Thank you for being here. And to our listeners, we also welcome your calls and comments. You can reach out on social media. You can email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, or you can give us a call at 904-549-2937. So, Darshini, you spoke before the Duval County School Board earlier this month, and you presented a stark assessment of what's happening in school hallways and classrooms every single day. What did you tell the school board?
So, me and a bunch of my peers went and spoke to the school board about the epidemic of sexual harassment that has been going on in Duval County public schools, and we offered testimonies and some solutions to what we believe would benefit Duval County.
And describe for people who don't know and maybe didn't see your presentation, describe the problem as you see it.
So first, let me like just say Title IX is basically just a law, a federal law that prevents students from discrimination on the basis of gender. And it calls for gender equality in schools and things like that. And so the problem is just that students don't know what Title IX is first. So they obviously can't really tell how it's going to help them, how it can protect them. And it's just not a well-known law that it should be. It should be, there should be a lot more education on it. And that's what we're trying to enforce right now.
So the problem, I mean, certainly is that Title IX, and we'll get to kind of some of the details about what that is and what protections it provides in a minute. But in terms of the problem that precipitates that, you know, what is the need for protections in the first place? Like, what is the problem that you're seeing and hearing about in classrooms and in the hallways?
Well, sexual harassment or assault, it happens in classrooms, and it's just students don't really know, first of all, what the definition of sexual harassment is and how teachers and other school staff can help them when they can help survivors when they have been assaulted or harassed in any way. So just that education and knowing what it is and how to help it, because hearing stories, and a lot of people have experienced this not only in Duval County, but in public schools. So it's just that education is just so crucial.
So I want to ask you, I mean, how prevalent a problem is it?
Oh, it happens all the time. Like sexual harassment, period. It's a thing that just is constant, which is really sad.
Uh-huh. Was there any particular moment or story or incident that you became aware of that prompted you to become involved in this issue?
I've been hearing stories my entire life, or seeing it on social media, or hearing it from another friend. So it's just things like that.
It wasn't like a particular incident?
Not entirely, no.
Okay. Julia, you're joining us via video. You founded the Ruth Project, which is a national gender equity group, but you're from Florida originally. What need did you see that prompted you to start and to found the organization?
I founded the Ruth Project at 16 years old. So at the time, it was in direct response to a litany of gender discrimination that myself and my peers were witnessing in public schools. And having started it in Florida, I can confidently say that gender discrimination takes many forms in public schools. It's extremely widespread, whether it's condescending comments towards students, whether it's, you know, informal comments telling female students that they don't have to be good at math, or especially sexual harassment. There would be designated days that students would designate where they could catcall students in the hallways. It wasn't uncommon to be groped in the hallways on your way to class. And this is like a very well-recognized reality for a lot of students. beyond receiving testimonies, when we informally talk to students about sexual harassment in public schools that we're seeing, we keep getting very similar stories. Catcalling, groping, sometimes direct assault in schools, and students not feeling a network of support where they can go to resolve a lot of these issues. Or, unfortunately, we're also receiving a lot of reports where when students do report, they're running into the issue of teachers or school staff saying, oh, well, that was just a boy showing you he had a crush on you. When in reality, that's sexual harassment, and it's sexual harassment that's going unrecognized and unnamed.
We're talking about the issue of sexual harassment and discrimination in schools, and we welcome your calls and comments. You can give us a call at 904-549-2937. You can also email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Ruth, you've said that Julia, you said the Ruth Project is not an awareness organization, that it's an organization that really is designed to inspire and train young people for activism. Explain what the difference is there in your mind between like an awareness organization.
Absolutely. When we say that, we really mean that we put all of our energy into training students to be direct advocates. So we'll talk about issues on social media from an education standpoint, but overwhelmingly our work is focused on ensuring that we are training people to pursue direct action. And so we work with tons of high school students across the United States, working with them one-on-one typically to develop advanced advocacy skills and helping them with the strategy to ensure that we are confronting the gender discrimination they're seeing in their schools.
So let's talk a little bit about Title IX, what it is, what protections that it offers. Obviously, this is something, Darshini, that you're pretty well versed in right now. Yeah. So tell us what you want people to know about Title IX.
Well, Title IX is a federal law, so it federally protects students from any sort of gender discrimination in schools, and it also allows them to have a formal investigation done when it is reported.
Okay. And so that is something that can be initiated with a complaint. If a complaint is initiated against another student or even a teacher, what protocols are supposed to happen then to either prevent retaliation or to give that student some sort of sense of security?
Yeah, there can be a lot of things done, just as simple as maybe changing the survivor's schedule so they don't have to interact with that whoever harassed them or assaulted them, so that there's just like small things that can be done like that to support survivors.
And what about a right to a timely investigation? I mean, is that also something that, is there a timeline that is set in place, or is that just sort of up to interpretation?
It should be within the first couple months. The complaint should be seen and addressed.
Mm-hmm. And so if a student is going to report, is there somebody that they ought to be seeking out to report to? Is that just a teacher or a trusted adult, or is there a designated person?
Every school staff is a mandatory reporter, but every school does have a specific Title IX coordinator that is part of the federal law. But every single school staff should be reporting any issues that they see or hear to the Title IX director. And there's also for Duval County a Title IX coordinator that kind of oversees all of this and deals with more issues.
So there's somebody in every school that is designated to be the Title IX coordinator or director?
Yes, exactly.
And are students taught who that is and how to reach that person?
Not really. At least I didn't know until I actually started doing my research on it. It's just not something students are aware of.
Julia, you know, activism, it's just one of many things that, you know, your organization does, this specific topic. But is Florida, you know, better or worse? I mean, you work nationally on this issue. Is Florida better or worse when it comes to Title IX compliance generally?
I will say that we're seeing an epidemic, particularly in K-12 public schools, of a lack of Title IX compliance and a lack of Title IX awareness. The issues that we're seeing in Florida compound that issue that's prevailing of not much awareness about Title IX because we can't pursue as many preventative measures as we might be able to in other states. Especially teaching of consent is widely recognized to be one of the most important things educational institutions can do to prevent continued sexual violence. But typically, students aren't taught what consent is. Sexual education in Florida is very minimal. We're restricted by state law. Sexual education also is not allowed to cover any forms of sex ed that apply to LGBTQIA plus people. And that group particularly, LGBTQIA plus people, are one of the groups that is at highest risk for sexual violence. And this is what the data is telling us. And so there's an issue of, yes, schools not listening to students in some cases and schools not properly implementing Title IX, but there's also a larger issue of state legislation restricting our ability to pursue much needed preventative measures.
Talk about teaching consent in the context of a school system that restricts or really limits sex ed. Like, how difficult is it to teach about consent when you're not talking about sex?
Well, part of the issue is under an abstinence-only sexual education framework, consent doesn't really enter the discussion, right? Because if the assumption is that sexual activity isn't occurring, then consent doesn't really enter that discussion. And this is important in the context of sexual harassment, that students are taught no means no. You cannot touch someone, you should not talk about someone, you should not threaten someone. Unless like you should not engage in those activities, and especially with regard to sexual activity, teaching them, like, if someone says no, if someone is intoxicated, if someone is unable to consent, then that activity should never be occurring. And that is, like, one of the most important things schools can teach students. But with no sexual education beyond basic biology taught to lower grade levels is occurring at large, there really are very few instances in which students are taught this other than when individual teachers maybe take it upon themselves. But under state law, it's very hard to bring that into the curriculum, and it's quite likely to be challenged if it is.
And Julia, I know you're a fairly recent graduate. Darshini, what kind of education did you receive in terms of the rules of consent?
I basically received nothing on, at least in my school. Well, my school does offer a class that is kind of mandatory for AP students to take that does talk about it, but it's a very abstinence pro class where you shouldn't really be having sex until you're married. So there's not really a lot of teaching that you just about no means no about what sexual harassment is and those kinds of definitions.
And, you know, we often think about teaching, you know, consent from the standpoint of, you know, people being empowered to say no. But certainly that education is valuable for people who are perhaps not knowing the rules of what kind of consent they need to obtain from someone.
Yeah.
In that kind of setting. And so that training is not just for people who are, you know, on the receiving end of some sort of, you know, behavior they might not want, but people who are perpetrating it and perhaps don't realize that they're doing so.
Yeah, exactly. That's why it's so crucial that this is taught to students.
Mm-hmm. So I want to talk to you about I want to read an email first. Mackenzie emailed. She said, I think these students are showing a great deal of bravery taking on this problem. With the recent documentary about sexual assault at Nickelodeon, Quiet on the Set, it shows how little power these students and kids have. I think the strategy of speaking out and organizing is a way of regaining some of that power for these students. WJCT platforming them is also helpful. So Darshini, talk about what you, this was not the first time you spoke to the school board this month. You've done so previously. So tell us a little bit about how those experiences were different, if they were, and what kind of response you've gotten from the school board members.
Yeah, this time I spoke with a lot of other peers, which I think really prompted the school board to see that this is a widespread issue And we got a lot of positive response from the school board. Hopefully we get to meet with them soon and kind of discuss the next steps that we should take to help protect survivors and students.
And you said that there were some almost immediate tangible responses that you saw around your school in terms of like signage. Is that right?
Yeah, there were posters that went up around my school, which is really great.
And what do they say? What kind of information do they have?
Well, the posters are great. They have a QR code that you can scan and it takes you to resources, but none of those resources have Title IX or sexual harassment on them. It's a lot of mental health awareness, which is absolutely amazing, but we're really aiming for more sexual harassment, Title IX, things to coordinate.
You want specifically kids to know what resources they have and who to go to.
Exactly.
Yeah. So you started a change.org petition.
Yes.
Tell me about what the petition says, what it asks people to do.
Well, I made this petition back in 2022, and it just basically says there is an epidemic of sexual harassment in our schools, and you just sign to kind of show people that people are on board with this. It's not just one student who's like, oh, there's a problem. There is many, many students who are feeling that this is a problem in DCPS. And there's also a form where you can fill out a testimony where if you've experienced sexual harassment, you can fill out a form that states so. And it's really empowering for survivors.
And that's an anonymous, or at least you anonymize it when you're presenting it.
Yes.
Yeah. But so you share some of those testimonies with the school board.
Yes.
Yeah. And is that helpful in conveying to them, do you think, or to the larger community, the specific problem?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Because it shows individual survivors' stories. So it personalizes the issue and it shows that it's happening everywhere. It's happening to students of all ages. It's not just a high school problem. There are so many students who remember these events clear as day from, as you said, as young as first grade. So it shows that it has impacted students in the long term as well.
And so some of these testimonies that you're getting are not necessarily this is what's happening right now, but this is what's happened to me in the past.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
So I'm curious how you kind of came to your place in being an advocate, being, you know, in your high school years at strong feminist, you know, willing to tackle an issue like this. Is that something that you come by naturally, or is that something that you've worked toward?
Well, yeah, I consider myself to have always been a feminist, and I've always wanted to be part of some sort of action, like from a very, very young age. And so I didn't want to have to wait until I was an adult to be part of the change that I felt was needed in my community. So when I came across the Ruth Project on social media, I was like, oh my God, this is the coolest thing ever. I would love to be a part of it. So I contacted Julia and here we are.
And so has your family been generally supportive of your ambitions?
Yeah, my dad's listening to me right now.
Mm-hmm. And did he have a nickname for you when you were smaller?
Oh, yeah. He used to call me his little feminist when I was younger.
And why would he call you that? What kind of things were you doing at that time that kind of presented who you were going to grow into?
Anytime a teacher was like, oh, I need a strong man to help me lift these chairs, my hand was always the first one to go up. I prided myself on being able to out-talk all the guys and answer the questions first. I was doing a lot of things.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you, Julia, about the Ruth Project. You know, you have said that there are obviously the question of sex education is a big thing, and that's a big part of the problem as you see it in Florida. But sort of the South writ large has had some issues. Can you talk about the experience that you see and the stories that you hear, particularly from Southern states?
Absolutely. So most of our work on sexual harassment has occurred mostly in the South, and we've done a lot of similar work in Texas and Georgia as well. And one of the things that we keep continually seeing is sexual harassment occurring and students realizing either months or even years later, oh my God, that's what happened to me. And a lot of the time that's when students come across descriptions of what sexual harassment is on social media. And it's this moment for a lot of students where it's like, that thing that made me uncomfortable that I was told was just, you know, a boy having a crush on me years ago, that was sexual harassment. And that for many students is a really big deal. It's, it kind of almost questions like what we've been taught and like what, how safe our schools are. And we're told that schools are supposed to be a safe place for learning, but for students who are being sexually harassed by their peers, it is not a safe space. In some cases, they might be sitting in class next to their harasser or assaulter, and that has long-term impacts on their educational success, mental health, and well-being. In fact, every student we've had who has filled out our testimony form telling us what's happened to them has said that this impacted their mental health long-term. A lot of these cases occur spanning from first grade all the way to the end of high school. And in almost every case where students report, they're seeing either incomplete investigations, if any, and those are very rare, or they're seeing a lot of dismissals. Sometimes teachers are even, you know, kind of playing pranks on students or dismissing them or being like, oh, let me sit you next to this one person because it's funny. When in reality, like, sexual harassment is occurring writ large in these districts, and it's being extremely unspoken for a lot of people because it's so uncomfortable because there's not a system that even recognizes that it's occurring. The data shows us that 1 in 9 minors experience sexual harassment, and almost 90% of those minors are women. And that's extremely significant. The data is so clear that sexual harassment is occurring in schools, and yet educational policies are lagging severely behind.
And so what do you tell people when you're trying to educate them about sexual harassment and what it is? I mean, it may be without that sort of education that certain forms of it pass under the radar, either by teachers or students who are experiencing it.
Absolutely. What we really try to communicate is that sexual harassment includes any either physical, verbal, or like implied sexual intention that's uncomfortable or unwanted. This could be verbal, this could be even as little as like a look, this could be body language, this could be physical touch. Often this includes catcalling, groping, actual assault. This can include harassing students online, asking for sexually explicit pictures. That's another thing students are commonly experiencing a lot these days. That is a form of sexual harassment. And so making it clear that unwanted sexual advances of any kind are sexual harassment.
We've got an email from Brianna. She says, maybe it's time to change the conversation about sexual assault and abuse. Turn it away from making the victim's responsibility to prevent it and speak up after the fact, and instead target potential abusers. Those who assault people don't care one way or the other about consent, but maybe promoting what could happen to them legally, parents finding out, loss of scholarships or post-high school activities, etc., might speak to them more. They are the ones who do and should bear the responsibility. Darshini, what of that? I mean, how much of the work that you do can be communicating to perpetrators potential penalties or repercussions for their behavior? And how much emphasis do you think should be put on that versus educating victims?
I think education is just so important to both the survivors and, like you said, the perpetrators, because maybe they just informing of what sexual harassment is so important. But also, yes, there are repercussions. There are so many things that could happen, at least not even just from a school point, but from a legal standpoint as well, because it is sexual harassment of a minor, which is really enforced by the law. So there should also be an emphasis on how, like, the penalties, but it should be more so on the education and the empowerment of these survivors.
Mm-hmm. And Julia, what about the penalties? How often are people penalized for violations of Title IX in terms of the students? And are teachers ever held responsible for failing to report or respond appropriately?
So recently, in the last 15 years or so, we're seeing some changes legally in terms of what happens when schools fail to respond to sexual harassment, most notably of which in 2007, a court actually held University of Colorado Boulder liable for not pursuing preventative measures after knowing there was a culture of sexual harassment and assault prevalent in their football program. And this is really significant because this is the first time we've ever, you know, that case in 2007 is the first time we've ever seen a court say that not providing preventative measures intended to address potential perpetrators could violate Title IX. Typically, we see this as an after-the-fact incident, but the reality is that very few students are actually held liable under Title IX. There's a very long hearing process typically, and the regulations do change every 4 years. So under the current Title IX regulations, survivors don't have as many rights as they have in the past. And these are still the Trump administration guidelines in place. So these have been in place for around 4 years now. And part of the thing we're seeing is that it's harder, there's higher standards of evidence in some cases, but it's harder for students to get penalties. A lot of times students go for informal resolutions instead of formal resolutions. So informal resolutions might entail a no contact order. They might entail a changing of a class schedule to ensure student doesn't have to be in the room with the perpetrator. But a lot of the times formal resolutions very rarely happen. And a lot of the times we're seeing this more as a criminal response. And Title IX is not brought into the picture as much as it should be when sexual violence is occurring on campuses.
So Darshini, what kind of response have you gotten from administrators and other students at your school? Has it been positive? Have you gotten any blowback?
No, I haven't gotten any blowback, especially like with sexual harassment. I don't feel as though there can not a lot of people. I've gotten mostly positive responses from peers as well as staff and admins. So that's been good.
Mm-hmm. I think of social media, I think as many people do, as a real difficult space to, I don't know, have any kind of conversations in a lot of cases. But when it's on a topic like this, I would think that it would be a particularly kind of nasty space. How has it been on this topic when you're, you know, communicating on Instagram or TikTok or whatever?
I feel like everyone, for the most part, as far as I've been seeing at least, have been extremely supportive of this advocacy. And I've had students even reach out to me saying how grateful they are that there's someone who can speak for those who have been silenced earlier and who don't feel as though they have a voice and are actually wanting change and are helping make this change happen in Duval County Schools.
And Julia, is it more difficult in this era when it comes to tracking harassment for young people when you're dealing with a medium that is, like, in a lot of ways fleeting and evanescent? You know, when people are making inappropriate comments, it might be on, you know, something like a Snapchat where the message is not sticking around. Is it harder to, I don't want to say police, but is it harder for people to build a case when there are Title IX violations because of the nature of social media?
Absolutely. In some cases, social media has been helpful when it provides a concrete record. Some students have even used things like text messages to provide evidence. But I mean, we also have to take into account, you know, is this evidence really trusted by the investigative bodies that are doing the Title IX investigation? And it really depends on what they provide, but sometimes social media can be helpful. But the vast majority of the time, especially when we're talking about temporary messages, things that are easily deleted, which is overwhelmingly how a lot of sexual harassment does occur, it's not helpful for students. You know, it's very hard to say this happened to me when all of a sudden all the evidence of that is gone. And that speaks to a larger issue that survivors face, is providing evidence when they go through the investigative procedures. That's still very much a struggle And very much a weakness of the process at overall in terms of supporting survivors.
So Darshini, what happens next? What steps are you expecting from the school board? What is your plan going forward in terms of, you know, accountability?
Yeah, so basically after meeting with the school board, maybe some more education in assemblies or as well as the posters specifically about Title IX and sexual harassment, providing definitions and such. But I feel like those are the main kind of points that we're trying to hit on, at least for right now, making sure students are immediately referred to some sort of mental health counselor when they do report some sort of sexual violence, sexual assault, harassment, etc.
And have you heard directly from any of the school board members?
Yeah, we've heard from a good amount of them, and they seem really excited and happy to help us with our cause.
Well, Darshini, Julia, thank you both so much for being here and talking about this important issue. Your work is really admirable.
Thank you so much for having
thank
us
you.
Today.
Yeah, thank you. Up next, we're going to be talking to a survivor of sudden cardiac arrest about what lessons can be learned from her experience ahead of a forum on this topic. Welcome back. Every year, more than 350,000 people experience sudden cardiac arrest outside of a hospital, according to the American Heart Association, and 90% of the time, it's fatal. I'm joined now by pediatric cardiologist with Wolfson Children's Hospital, Khushbu Parikh. Good morning, Dr. Parikh.
Good morning, Anne.
And also on the line, sudden cardiac arrest survivor Lexi Seema. Good morning, Lexi. Good morning, Lexi.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you so much for joining us. Lexi, why don't we start off by you telling us what happened to you when you were a teenager?
Sure. When I was 16 years old, I was running on a treadmill, you know, doing something I've done every day of my life. I grew up an avid athlete, so this is no different day for me. While I was running on that treadmill, I went into sudden cardiac arrest, and before I even hit the floor, my heart had stopped. So thankfully, there was three people there who knew CPR and to grab an AED. So I was revived before I ever even saw an ambulance or went back to a hospital. And from that point, I had a ICD, which is an internal defibrillator, implanted, and I'm a healthy adult now.
And this was when you were 16 years old. Can I ask how old you are now?
Sure. I am 24 now.
Okay. And do you have a child of your own?
I do. I now have, she'll be 2 in April.
Congratulations. What, if
yes.
anything,
yep.
Do you watch out for with her having had your experience? Is there anything that can be done at this stage to kind of look at whatever risk might be hereditary?
Yes. So they're not quite sure what condition I do have. I've had every testing in the book. But from the point that I got pregnant with my daughter, I had another round of genetic testing done because every year there's new genetic panels and genes that are coming out and being studied. So I had another genetic panel done. And then every 6 months to a year, she is being seen by an electrophysiologist just to make sure that everything is normal with her heart structure and rhythm. And she actually sees them on Tuesday just for another follow-up, but it's really just keeping in touch with her electrophysiologist to make sure that everything is still normal.
And Lexi, did you experience any symptoms before this happened when you were 16 years old?
No, not that I remember at all.
Mm-hmm. So Dr. Breek, what is sudden cardiac arrest and how is it different or distinct from just a heart attack?
So sudden cardiac arrest is essentially an electrical malfunction in the heart, wherein the heart just stops pumping blood to the organs, or essentially is an inefficient pumping. So vital organs like brain, lungs, kidneys stop getting perfused, and patients pass out or lose consciousness.
And a heart attack is something different than that, I guess.
Correct. So heart attack is more when you have the coronary arteries that supply the muscles of the heart, they get blocked or impede blood flow. So it's more like a plumbing problem versus an electrical malfunction, which is a sudden cardiac arrest.
And so how does this electrical malfunction occur?
So it could be from a varied etiologies. So whether it's pediatric or adult, both of them can have it. And in our realm of pediatrics, we see more in terms of anatomical problems or congenital heart defects that they are born with. It could be from thickening of heart muscles, which is called cardiomyopathies. It can be from abnormal electrical pathologies like channelopathies, what we call them. So a myriad of conditions could cause sudden cardiac arrest.
And that last one is kind of a medical term, but is that something that can be initiated by like a hard contact of some kind?
Yes. So it could be what we saw in Damar Hamlin's case. So it was when if you're hit on the chest at the correct time, or not a correct, but an inappropriate time on the electrical rhythm of the heart, then that puts you in what's called this non-perfusing rhythm, and that puts you in at risk for cardiac arrest.
And so Lexi says that she's gone through a number of tests. Mm-hmm. They still don't know what her particular ailment is. So how are you able to test for a condition like this in advance?
So there are, yes. So we look for certain findings on EKGs, certain findings on echocardiograms. And then if there is a strong family history of sudden cardiac arrest, then we test for genetics and see if they're positive for any genes that could be associated with sudden cardiac arrest. But yes, there's still so much out there that we don't know. So still there are some conditions that we end up not able to identify or pinpoint as a cause of the sudden cardiac arrest.
But you are a pediatric cardiologist, which is a unique specialty. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people think of heart disease and heart ailments affecting much older populations. And we said at the beginning that, you know, sudden cardiac arrest affects hundreds of thousands of people every year. But what is specifically the problem as it pertains to children?
So in our athletes, so a large part of our athletes are still teenagers, which falls in the realm of our pediatric practice. And like congenital heart diseases or diseases that you're born with, basically your heart is formed differently. Those fall into our realm. So abnormalities of these coronary arteries, so basically blood vessels that supply the heart muscles, if they are arising from an abnormal location, or if they have a genetic condition of thickening of their heart muscles, which prevents inadequate pumping, or also electrical malfunctioning in the heart, or what we called channelopathies or abnormal electrical functioning of the heart, or genes that affect the function or electrical functioning of the heart, can all of these are seen much earlier, and we see them more in the pediatric age group. And so those are some of the things that we look for when we are assessing for, or at least I try to identify kids if they are at risk for sudden cardiac arrest.
And so how many people are affected? How many children are affected?
It's the incidence varies, but it's somewhere between 1 in 50,000 to 100,000 athletes a year.
And is that in the globally? United States?
No, that's not the National College yet, the NCAA.
Okay. Yeah. And so there have been, as you alluded to, there have been a few very high profile instances of athletes, professional athletes, you know, collapsing mm-hmm. on camera mm-hmm. And, you know, having to be revived quickly. Obviously, time is very important. Mm-hmm. How do those incidents help raise awareness? Have you seen a greater awareness of the risks of sudden cardiac arrest?
Yeah, I think in the recent years, we have seen a lot of awareness for teenagers, especially collapsing on the fields, and the concept of sudden cardiac arrest in pediatric population. Not just like on the TV when we see, but a lot of like students, high school students, when they are playing. And if there's a certain kid who has a sudden cardiac arrest on the field, that raises awareness among coaches and teachers and parents to test their kids, to take some of their symptoms more seriously and get them evaluated by the pediatrician, get them evaluated by a cardiologist. In the recent years, because of this uptick in awareness, overall, we've seen a lower incidence. We've seen the incidence fall a little bit in the sudden cardiac arrest.
Lexi, I know that your father has been active in trying to make sure that there are, defibrillator machines available, particularly on the sidelines, working with legislators to change the law to improve, those the availability of those types of machines. You've also been, an active voice on this issue. So why is it important to you and to your father to, be out in front of this issue and talking about it?
Well, yeah, exactly like you just said, it really takes just so much awareness because, when I was a 16-year-old and I died for no reason, everyone that was affected in our life is kind of had the same reaction. This only happens to old people. What the heck is this? So as much as, it is horrible that these stories are coming out, it really is a key piece to the puzzle to kind of make these people aware, just the general public, that these things do happen. And that comes into play with the AEDs and the CPR cardiac response plans as well, because it really just is the awareness of recognizing the issue and then, having an action plan to live it out. Something that we always say is, I'm only alive because I was lucky. I'm only alive. I'm one of that 10%, as you previously stated, that live from this. And I'm lucky that there is an AED. I'm lucky that there are people there who know how to do it. But this is something that really should be the law. So something we always say is, law, not luck, because most of the people that we do meet that are survivors, is it really comes down to they were in the right place at the right time with the right people. And so it really just is so important for, the advocacy to say this does happen. It's not a freak accident, and to have a response plan to know what to do if and when this does happen.
And Dr. Parikh, she talks about having an AED available. That is really necessary in these situations. And I think we've learned that CPR maybe isn't as effective in, outside of a hospital setting as we'd like to think.
So yes, AEDs are important. And yes, I think a lot of schools now have it in their gyms, and we see it at the airports. We see it in a lot of public places. But bystander CPR is also just as much important. Effective CPR is what we are looking for. So yes, it is. You need to have at least some training or some experience in giving what's called effective CPR so that it supports blood flow to your brain. That's the whole idea, is when you're doing the CPR.
Well, Dr. Parikh, I know that you're going to be part of a panel here at WJCT Studios on April 3rd at 5:30 p.m. Thank you so much for being here today, sharing this. Lexi, thanks so much for sharing your story with us.
Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you for having us.
And in just a minute, what do honey, soap, flowers, and worms have in common? Stick around and find out.
LifeSouth Community Blood Centers, providing blood and patient services to the local hospitals, serving patients in this community. Donating blood with LifeSouth helps save lives. More at lifesouth.org to find a blood drive near you.
Generation W's annual conference themed Believe takes place April 5th and features energizing, inspiring, dynamic speakers and workshops to enrich your life. Tickets at genwnow.com. Seeing is believing.
Europe is looking to recruit new soldiers. Military officials say they need more troops in case Russia's war in Ukraine expands. We're talking pay increases, enlisting women, bringing back the draft. Everything is on the table. Europe's troop deficit, next time on The World.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, Carrie Brownstein and Corin Tucker, co-founders of the band Slater Kenny. Rolling Stone called them the best American punk rock band ever. While they were working on their latest album, Little Rope, Brownstein's mother died in an auto accident. They'll talk about how grief affected their music and what it's like to make music together for decades. Join us
today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
This year's presidential election is on track to be the costliest ever. Right now, Biden's war chest dwarfs that of his rival, and the presumptive Republican presidential nominee has other money worries of his own. Who's raising what, and how is it being used? And how might election dollars fuel the chances for third-party candidates looking to make their mark? That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, it's time to nurture your interest in nature. The Garden Club of Jacksonville hosts its annual extravaganza this Saturday, and I'm joined now by the Garden Club's executive director and my former colleague and Alt Weekly editor, Denise Reagan. Hey, Denise.
Good morning, Ann.
And beekeeper at the Urban Bee, Mika Hardison. Good morning, Mika.
Good morning.
Denise, I haven't seen you since you lost your mother last fall, and I just want to say our condolences. She was an incredible activist for Springfield and all things Clutho. And Norman Studios. So our thoughts with you about Rita.
Thank you very much.
But her spirit lives on, and this is a season of renewals. So tell us about this annual event. Lots of things going on.
Yeah, well, Blooms Galore and More has been going on for years. I don't know exactly how many. It predates me at the Garden Club. But we've really exploded it over the last several years. And it's bigger and better than ever. So the foundation of it is our plant sale, and the majority of that are plants that are propagated by our members and donated to us over that week leading up to it. And we set them up in our backyard, our giant parking lot, and sell hundreds and hundreds of beautiful plants that all help to, you know, raise money for the Garden Club.
And these are plants, as you say, that are grown by some of the best green thumbs in the city. But that means that you're able to sell things and people are able to buy plants that you might not find at your average nursery.
That's right. That's right. Because you don't know what's growing in people's backyards until you come and find them.
Mm-hmm. And so, Mika, you are a urban beekeeper. You're the beekeeper of the Urban Bee. It's H-E-R-B-A-N.
Correct.
But what is the what are the challenges of being an urban beekeeper as opposed to, you know, I think we often think of it as happening in a more rural setting, kind of a farm-like setting. Is it a different set of pollinators? Is it a different set of challenges?
The biggest challenge is land access. So for individuals who don't have acres and acres or access to a farm, per se, the urban environment is rich with flora. And as a matter of fact, urban honey tends to have a lot less pesticide pressure and pesticides in it than a lot of rural areas. Because, you know, in urban areas, lawns aren't as manicured as in suburban HOA communities.
Interesting. And how much land do you need to keep bees?
Oh, not much. You know, not much. People do it right in their backyard.
What got you started?
I am a homesteader. So my goal is to create enough food at my house for my family. So being able to maximize that space is important. And bees make a plant that was maybe going to produce 2 cucumbers, produce 5.
Did you have any, I know some people are just kind of afraid of bees. I mean, did you have any concerns about getting into it from that standpoint?
No, I'm fearless. No, I really didn't have many concerns with that. I'm a nature girl. I love nature. I love all things natural. And so beekeeping just was the next step for me.
And so what do you bring to the garden show?
I bring honey. And so our main product that we sell is we sell honey, but we also do honey infusions. Mm-hmm. So we take something yummy and beneficial to you like ginger, and we combine it with honey and we infuse it and sew those. So we do hot honey, ginger honey, roselle hibiscus.
Your two favorites.
Which one is?
Honey, the hot honey and the ginger honey.
What do you put it on?
Everything.
Okay.
Absolutely. People put it on their fish, on their chicken, in their tea.
It's great strong on toast.
On toast, ice cream. It's a thing.
I love that you're, Denise, you're going for the hot stuff even for breakfast, which
always.
It's a good habit to get into, I think. So you are going to be at this event. There's a lot of things for kids, too. It's not just for grown-ups looking for plants. So tell us what else is on deck for younger people.
That's right. So we have our monthly program called Budding Gardeners, which is for children in grades 1 through 6. But so since Blooms Galore takes place around the same time, we're having a Budding Gardeners at Blooms Galore. And one of the things is a great scavenger hunt that takes place across the entire campus, and there are prizes for the scavenger hunt. There are all sorts of nature-themed activities and lawn games, and we're hoping if the weather's good, there will be bunnies.
Oh, awesome. And so there is the event itself is on April 6th. For people who don't know where the Garden Club is and how to participate, where do they go?
Yeah, so the Garden Club is at 1005 Riverside Avenue. We're right next door to the Keimer Museum at the corner of Riverside Avenue and Post Street.
Okay, and so that's on April 6th. What time of day? And then tell me a little bit about the preview party just briefly.
Yeah, so the main event happens on Saturday, April 6th, 9 a.m. to 3 p.m., so all day long, that's free for anybody who wants to come, buy your plants, go to our vendors. We have more than 24 vendors selling plants, honey, soap, jewelry, artwork, sweets. We also have a series of mini presentations, kind of lightning talks by a lot of those vendors who, you know, will be telling you some tips and some really fun things. And then we have a really convenient plant pickup system. So like anything you buy, we'll put it in your car for it and you can drive away with it.
Excellent. Well, Denise Reagan and Mika Hardison, thanks for bringing the blooms to us here in the studio. We appreciate it. And good luck with the event.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our program. We encourage you to send your feedback or suggestions for future segments to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And if you missed anything, you can catch our rebroadcast at 8 o'clock tonight, or you can find our entire archive at wjct.org or on your favorite podcast platform. Tomorrow on First Coast Connect, we look back at the origins of the JEA criminal case with City Council President Ron Salem. I'm Ann Schindler. You've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.